Iran's defense minister dismisses the recent Israeli threats, saying that Tehran will give a crushing response to any unwise move. British households are bracing for a second large increase in energy bills in just 12 months as gas and electricity prices soar. At least six people are confirmed dead and several more injured in a shooting incident on a Russian university campus. Hi, this is World News from Tehran. I'm Erzan Tafi. Good to have you with us. Iran's Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani has played down recent Israeli threats against his country. He says the Islamic Republic will give a crushing response to any likely act of aggression. In our news review program just an hour ago, we've discussed that matter with our guests. Iran's defense minister has played down the recent Israeli threats against his country, saying that the Islamic Republic will give a crushing response to any unwise move. Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani says Israel's recent allegations against Iran are out of desperation. He warned that Tel Aviv will pay dearly for any act of aggression. Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid recently accused Iran of marching toward a nuclear weapon. He also threatened the regime will act if the world fails to stop Iran from obtaining nuclear capabilities. Iran has time and again said that its nuclear program is non-military and solely for civilian purposes, including power generation. Now let me invite a couple of guests to see what they think about the story so far. He's at a university professor and public analyst is joining me from Tehran. Also, Edward Carrigan, international human rights lawyer, is joining us from London, Ontario. Professor Izadi, this is not the first time that such things are being mentioned. We have Israel openly threatening Iran, and then Iran also warning against such threats, and that saying that we're standing firm here, and in case we come under attack, you will be also facing it. So, Mr. Izadi, the funny thing was the last part that Israel said, if the world fails to stop Iran, what did it mean by the world fails? The IAEA has on 15 times, as far as I remember, multiple locations confirmed Iran is not moving toward a nuclear proliferation. And as you know, Islam has banned it. That Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Council also said there's an edict that prohibits Iran from accessing and moving toward any proliferation of nuclear weapons. So what's Israel talking about?
Well, you know, this is what the Israelis have been doing for many years, claiming that Iran is few months away from the nuclear weapon, and they have been doing that since the 1990s. Mm. And obviously, there is no nuclear weapon, there is no nuclear weapon program, and this is not just what the International Atomic Energy Agency says, that there is no diversion of enriched material. This is what the U.S. intelligence community has also stated, that Iran does not have a nuclear weapon program, and whether Iran wants to start one or not, they say they don't know. They know that Iran is not planning to do that. But in their official statements, including the worldwide threat assessment that they issue every year, this is a sentence that repeats itself for the last many years. So the Israelis know that Iran is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. The Americans know that. Why are they talking about that? This is the title of Garrett Porter's book, the American author. They're manufacturing a crisis. There is no crisis, but they're manufacturing one. And they don't like what happened in Iran 40 years ago with the Islamic Revolution. They don't like Iran's foreign policy. And instead of just coming and saying that, they accuse Iran of something. And then they want to put pressure on Iran, they want to put sanctions on Iran. This is an excuse for attacking Iran through different means that they have, and obviously Iran is capable of defending itself, and they have, Iran has done that for many, many years, and Iran will continue to do that, as the general said.
Okay, Mr. Kargan, how serious should we take this Israeli threat, threats on top of threat every other day? And if such a thing happens, and if Israel takes military action, what will the repercussions be?
Well, Israel has taken action against Iran on numerous occasions. There has been an Israeli campaign of assassination against the leading Iranian scientists, including not too long ago, the head of the Iranian nuclear program was killed in Iran. So Israel is taking action. And whenever they're embarrassed, like they were with the prisoners who escaped, and then they pose collective punishment on the prisoners, so they're getting criticism of that. But I also think that they're playing to the Israeli audience, and they're trying to distract the world from a recent lawsuit that Iranians made against the United States for Israel's assassination of a number of Iranian scientists. So this is a distraction and trying to show that, yes, we think Iran is a threat, then somehow this absolves Israel for its campaign of targeted assassination of Iranian scientists. And it's to, as I said, it's a distraction and for political reasons. But Israel has made these threats, you know, from the 1990s as professorship, and maybe even earlier, you know. And this is, of course, a double standard, because we know that Israel has nuclear weapons, some estimates between 40 and 400, and that they were collaborating with the apartheid state of South Africa in developing nuclear weapons. And, of course, they are always pointing, well, Iran may get nuclear weapons. So Israel has nuclear weapons. Israel has very aggressively attacked all of its neighbors over the years, when Iran hasn't attacked any of its neighbors in nearly 300 years.
Thank you very much for your comments. Fadi Zedi, University Professor and Political Analyst in Tehran, and Edward Kargan, International Human Rights Lawyer in London, Ontario. That's all for this edition of the News Review. Moving on, gas prices have hit record highs in the UK, threatening consumers with huge power bills and small suppliers futures. A leading trade association for the UK offshore oil and gas industry says that wholesale prices for gas are up 250% since January. The figure shows a 70% increase since August. Experts say that households will get hit by surging power bills this coming winter, while small energy firms risk collapsing. The hike is largely blamed on high global demand and a fire that knocked out a vital point connecting the country's power grid to France. Supermarkets and food firms say the price rise has caused a shortage of carbon dioxide, which is threatening UK supplies of meat and fresh produce. The government has held an emergency meeting over the issue. Investigators have revised down the death toll to 6 in a shooting on a Russian university campus. They also corrected reports on the shooter having been killed. Investigators say that the assailant is alive and is receiving treatment at a hospital. The incident, which also injured 6 people, took place at Perm State University, close to the Ural Mountains. Terrified people were filmed escaping from a building through windows. The campus social media alerted everyone to leave if possible or lock themselves inside rooms. The reason for the shooting remains unknown. Staying with Russia, partial results from the parliamentary election show that the ruling United Russia Party has won the majority of the vote. With nearly 75% of the ballots counted, United Russia is ahead with almost half of the ballots. Its rival, the Communist Party, has only managed to secure around 20%, and that's a sign of weaker performance for the ruling party that won over 54% of the ballots in the last parliamentary poll. Kremlin critics accuse authorities of large-scale vote rigging, claiming that the election was in any case a sham. Our Moscow correspondent Marina Kortenova joined us a short while ago with some more information on the Russian parliamentary elections.
A total of 18 political parties participated in the elections to the 8th Russian State Duma, the lower house of parliament. And in addition to the State Duma elections, voters also cast their ballots for the heads of 9 Russian regions and members of 39 regional parliaments. So this morning I read the analytics, and this is what experts say about the elections. So the 8th state Duma became more left-wing, although the classical division into left and right has long been outdated. Parties with a socialist orientation, and these include at least four of them, received a total of about a third of the votes. That is 1.5 times more than in the last elections. So the Communist Party is gaining more than 20%, surpassing its best result in this century. So they reached 19% in the elections 10 years ago, but fallen short of its historic record, 24% in 1999.
Canadian voters are heading to the polls to choose members of the country's 44th parliament in a snap election. Surveys indicating that the Liberal Party, led by incumbent Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and the Conservative Party, led by Erin O'Toole, are neck and neck in the race. Six parties are contesting to achieve a majority government. A party needs to win at least 170 seats in the 338-member House of Commons. On August 15, Trudeau dissolved the parliament and called an early election, hoping his handling of the coronavirus pandemic would help his party win a majority. The Lebanese parliament is holding a plenary session for a vote of confidence on the proposed ministers of the country's new government. The session was held with a one-hour delay due to power cuts in the UNESCO building that currently houses the parliament. Lawmakers are also set to review the new cabinet's policy program in the session. Earlier this month, the country announced the formation of a new government after a long period of political deadlock. The new administration was formed after President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati officially signed a decree. Mikati has pledged to address the country's crippling economy. I talked to our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, in Beirut, and she has an update on the Lebanese parliament's plenary session for a vote of confidence on the proposed ministers of the new government.
We are witnessing the first meeting for the parliament after the formation of the Najib Mikati cabinet. And today we heard from the new prime minister, Mikati. We heard from him the manifesto, which is supposed to be the program of the cabinet, which will be studied by the parliament in order for them to give a vote of confidence to this cabinet. Now, usually we have these meetings that go on for 2, 3, 4 days sometimes. So many speeches by all the members of parliament. However, today we have seen from the Speaker of the Parliament insistence on the fact that this session be held only for today, and this could continue till the later hours in the afternoon, after which there will be a vote of confidence. Now, after the Prime Minister spoke about this manifesto, generally basically laying out the major problems that Lebanon is facing, stressing that there needs to be an addressing of those problems. He said the name of this cabinet is that of the cabinet of relief or the cabinet of salvation, a cabinet that should only look at what are the priorities of the people. What are the needs that need to be met in order for the people to live a life that could at least meet their basic needs at the minimum?
Muslims are descending on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala ahead of the Day of Arbaeen. The pilgrims are marching on the shrine city to join the annual gathering that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. The occasion this year falls on the 28th of September. The Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors due to the COVID pandemic. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred in an unequal battle with forces of the tyrant ruler of the time over 13 centuries ago. The battle, known as the Ashura event, is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. On September 20th, 2011, Press TV's cameraman Saeed Farhat Taghatusi was killed during a Taliban attack in Kabul. On the 10th anniversary of that incident, our correspondent Amin Alami has found the report.
It was in 2007 when Press TV began to operate in Afghanistan with a small but well-experienced team who are still working round the clock. They have done their best to be the voice of voiceless people in Afghanistan and even sacrificed their lives to shed light on the realities in this war-torn country. For instance, Press TV has lost two of its base cameramen in separate Taliban and Daesh attacks so far, and September coincides with the martyrdom anniversary of one of them, late Sayyid Farhad Taqaddusi. Following the martyrdom of Sayyid Farhad, Press TV hired his younger brother, Sayyid Najib Taqaddusi, who himself was working as a cameraman and editor in one of Afghanistan's leading news channels. Najib says, although it is impossible to forget the shock and pain of the loss of his brother, he is committed to following his path as a frontline soldier of press freedom in Afghanistan.
Farhad was very lovely. He was a responsible and hard-working man. His main goal was to turn Afghanistan into a better place for Afghans by promoting press freedom and making the voice of the voiceless heard. Of course, I will pursue the same goal.
Sayyid Mujtaba Taqaddusi is Farhad's uncle. In his eyes, the loss of Farhad was a huge blow to his entire family, friends and colleagues. But what makes his loss bearable is that he lost his life for the sake of a free and independent Afghanistan where all voices can be heard.
I personally cannot accept that Farhad is no more among us. His memory is with us and we keep his ideals and goals alive. He was a true servant of the oppressed Afghan people.
It was on September 20, 2011, when a group of armed Taliban militants captured a high-rise building in a heavily protected area of Kabul and began hitting different targets with rockets and mortar shells. One of those rockets hit Press TV office in Wazir Akbar Khan area, which killed Sayyid Farhad Taqaddusi. He was later led to rest in Western Kabul, and a high number of people attended his funeral ceremony. Sayyid Amin Alami, Kabul.
That's right for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khamenei's televised speech addressing the new wave of coronavirus, August 13, 2021. I spoke about the infection and death rates and the problems that ensue as a result of it. But this is one side of the matter. Another side of the matter is the extreme fatigue suffered by the health personnel. This is also a big concern. They are exposed to all kinds of physical and emotional pressures. So the health personnel, physicians, nurses, and other such people are doing an act of jihad. I wish to sincerely express my gratitude to these people, but my words of gratitude are of no significance. The most important thing is the gratitude of God, the Exalted, who is the thankful, the omniscient, and who sees all their efforts. I wish to raise some points with officials and some points with the people. What I want to say to officials is that during the spread of the disease, diagnostic tests became popular, which was a good action. This should be done. Both the health system and the mobilized forces, Basij, should help provide diagnostic tests extensively and for free.
Subhanallah.
Today, these tests are not conducted for everyone free of charge. There are certain problems. Individuals should pay some money, which is expensive for some people. Things should improve in a way that diagnosis and diagnostic tests become available for everyone. Of course, insurance companies should help. The administration should help so that the issue moves forward and is resolved. The next matter is about the vaccine. Well, fortunately, a number of vaccines were manufactured inside the country, and domestic production helped facilitate the importation of foreign vaccines as well, as acknowledged by officials as well. As for the importation of foreign vaccines, the administration and the Ministry of Health had purchased the vaccine from certain countries. They even paid the full price for them, but they broke their promise and did not deliver on their end of the bargain. After our own vaccine entered the market and after people began to use it, the situation improved and the path of imports was cleared as well.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has approved documents for Iran's full membership at the Eurasian Political, Economic, and Security Alliance. The decision came as the 21st summit of the organization opened in Dushanbe earlier in the day. The Islamic Republic joined the SCO in 2005 as an observer state.
SCO, with the current membership, covers close to 50% of the world population and about one-third of the world's GDP. Being a member of this organization will take a lot of pressure away in terms of Western sanctions, Western impositions, monetary manipulations via the US dollar as a remedy for payment. No more.
Leaders from eight member states and four observer states attended the annual summit in Tajikistan's capital on Friday with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping addressing it virtually along with Russian president. She criticized sanctions imposed on world economic exchanges, urging the SCO members to stay united against attacks by other countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his counterpart from Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan attended in person. Addressing the summit, President Raisi said the world today has entered a new era when hegemony and unilateralism are declining.
The world is entering a new era but a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
The Iranian president also underlined that sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. In his address at the SCO summit, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi described sanctions as economic terrorism and the hegemonic power's most important tool to impose their own will on the others. He warned that unilateral sanctions are not limited to one country, but as it has become clear in recent years, they include more independent countries, particularly the SCO member states. Two key members of the alliance, Russia and China, have also come under sanctions from the West. Ties between Washington and Beijing deteriorated after former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in 2017, waging an economic war against China. While many expected the current administration of Joe Biden to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies, it adopted a tougher stance against China and Russia, imposing several rounds of sanctions on them on various pretexts.
Western trade currency restrictions do not exist in the SCO member countries. This will drastically reduce the potential for Western sanctions and will increase, on the other hand, Iran's potential to deal with the East, for example, or especially China and Russia, entering partnership agreements with these and other SCO countries, benefiting from comparative advantages.
At the end of the summit, SCO member states signed the Dushanbe Declaration, in which they stress opposition to interference under the excuse of counterterrorism or human rights, or solving key international and regional issues through small cliques, ideology, or confrontation mentality. They also agreed on strengthening cooperation in cracking down on terrorism, extremism, and separatism, and reached a consensus in supporting building an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
The Israeli regime has reportedly started a cyber sabotage campaign in the UAE to interfere with the regional air and maritime navigation in West Asia.
Cyber warfare is becoming more and more important and more dangerous as well. So Israel wants to take advantage of any opportunities there.
The campaign seeks to disrupt the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman region's air and maritime navigation systems, thus destabilizing the regional security situation. On the other hand, the bid seeks to transit the focal point of crisis away from the occupied territories towards the region and therefore reduce the political and security pressure faced by the regime's ruling body. The UAE has signed dozens of memorandums of understanding with Israel since it became the first Arab state to normalize ties with Israel this century.
Israel sees itself with the Sunni monarchies and the conservatives as their potential allies in this. So it wants to be able to conduct the kind of cyber sabotage and infiltration that is becoming so so much more important. So it's not surprising that they would do this when they have the opportunity, and the UAE is providing that opportunity for them.
Israel has said that it expects $1 billion in trade with the UAE by the end of 2021 and $3 billion in 3 years. The UAE aims to raise the value of economic activity with Israel to more than $1 trillion in the next 10 years. According to regional observers, at the heart of the UAE's desire to normalize ties with the regime in Tel Aviv was its penchant for U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets, which the peace deals with Israel, known as the Abraham Accords, made possible. To the Persian Gulf state, established full diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime in a deal brokered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. Shortly after the deal was reached, the Trump administration authorized the sale of 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. The UAE and Israel are reportedly deepening their ties and espionage activities in the region. The The UAE has helped Israel set up a center for military and maritime reconnaissance on the strategic Yemeni island of Socotra. The Red Crescent Society of the United Arab Emirates has signed a contract with the Tel Aviv regime in order to create an intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at Socotra Airport. Socotra is home to some 60,000 people. It overlooks the Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route that connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It also has a unique ecosystem, which is already being exploited by the Emirates. The mission reportedly aimed at collecting information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab el-Mandab and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE. Socotra has been a source of tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. They have been jockeying for position for control of the island's unique resources in the absence of a powerful government in Yemen amid a ferocious war on the country. Back in June 2020, UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra.
As you know, Israel has always welcomed the opportunity to have alliances within what it has considered to be the enemy camp, namely the Arabs. And in the opportunity with an alliance is to profit in various ways, to build one's power through espionage.
A new security pact involving the United States, Britain, and Australia has triggered controversy and condemnation. The U.S. and U.K. announced this week that they will provide Australia with advanced technology to build nuclear-powered submarines. Based on their agreement, Australian naval forces will have atomic submarines that are much faster as they use nuclear propulsion systems and harder to detect than conventional fleets. They can spend months under the sea and target longer distances with their missiles. The leaders of the three countries hailed the new deal as a step that will make it easier to counter threats in the Indo-Pacific. They repeatedly mentioned regional security concerns, which they said had grown significantly. None of them mentioned China, but the pact is being widely viewed as an initiative to counter Chinese influence in the region, including in the contested resource-rich South China Sea.
Well, there are two elements here. One is the fact that this alliance could be a new version of NATO for Indo-Pacific region, and the other is that this purchase of nuclear-powered submarine could be an initial step to transfer more technology to nuclear technology to Australia, maybe in the long term having Australia acquiring nuclear bomb capacity.
The United States and its allies make no secret of their intensified efforts to try to contain the growing Chinese influence and power there. Many observers believe the newly announced deal is in line with those efforts. Meanwhile, the development is expected to further sour relations between Beijing and Canberra. In recent years, political tensions have grown between the two over a number of issues, including Australia's stance against Chinese telecom giant Huawei. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Xiao Lijian criticized what he called the U.S.-led alliance's obsolete Cold War mentality and warned the three countries against moves that would hurt their own interests. Some Chinese media went so far as to say that Australia had now turned itself into an adversary of China. What are the implications of this new pact and other moves against China for regional and international security? Meanwhile, China was not the only party infuriated by the new security pact. France condemned it too. That is because Australia will now scrap a deal with France to buy a dozen conventional submarines worth tens of billions of dollars. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called Australia's agreement with the U.S. and the U.K. a stab in the back. France said the development underscored the need to bolster a, quote, European strategic autonomy. The United States and arch-rival China may have toned down their rhetoric against each other, but tensions between the two superpowers are simmering as they remain deeply engaged in an intense global rivalry. There are many flashpoints in their testy relationship, including tensions in the South China Sea and the issue of Taiwan. America has made it clear that its military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch-rival. America seems determined to follow policies aimed at containing the Chinese influence worldwide. And with China absolutely unwilling to back down, tensions are expected to mount in the coming years.
The political climate created by the global war on terror after the 9/11 attacks set the stage for large increases in the Pentagon budget, much of which went to military contractors. A new article by Brown University's Cost of War Project has shed light on military spending by the Pentagon after 9/11. The Pentagon budget increased by over 10% in the first year after the 9/11 attacks and the commencement of the war in Afghanistan. The Pentagon budget untimely increased year after year for 10 years running and peaked in 2010 at the highest level since World War II.
President Eisenhower, when he was leaving office, talked about the military-industrial complex. And these are the people that supply the weapons for wars. And in order to have a war, you have to have some type of threat, and that was provided by 9/11, and they decided to cash in on that. This provided unique opportunities for stealing money.
The study says over $14 trillion was spent by the Pentagon since the start of the war in Afghanistan. The report says $4.4 trillion of the total spending went towards weapons procurement and research and development. That category directly benefited corporate military contractors. Out of the $4.4 trillion, the top five U.S. weapons makers, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, received $2.2 trillion, almost half. Besides getting paid for weapons and research, U.S. corporations profit from private contractors that are deployed to war zones. The most notorious private security contractor previously employed by the Pentagon is Blackwater. It is a mercenary group whose employees massacred 17 people in Iraq's Nasser Square back in 2007. The Pentagon also employed private contractors for just about every task in U.S. war zones. At the end of the Trump administration, only 2,500 U.S. troops were left in Afghanistan, but over 18,000 Pentagon contractors were still in the country.
And what we saw recently was that a lot of those weapons that got left behind were delivered within weeks of the end of the war. I mean, very close to pulling out, which meant that they had to unload them in order to cash in on what they were doing. It also unloaded them into a group of people who could use them to destabilize the region, which was also their intent.
The report explained how China is the new justification for military spending. As the U.S. has reduced the size of its military footprint in Iraq and Afghanistan, exaggerated estimates of the military challenges allegedly posed by China have become the new rationale of choice in arguments for keeping the Pentagon budget at historically high levels. The most likely impact of the shift towards China will be to further tighten the grip of major weapons makers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies on the Pentagon budget. Over the past few years, the U.S. has adopted a confrontational approach toward China. There are many contentious issues the two countries have been quarreling over.
China is much more complicated because both countries, China and the United States, are tied together economically in a way that would be very difficult to disentangle in short notice. The United States is dependent on China for a large bulk of its manufacturers, including crucial manufacturers like computer chips.
The U.S. accuses China of genocide against the Uyghur population in the province of Xinjiang. China has rejected the accusations, asking the US to stop interfering in what Beijing considers its internal affairs. The two countries have also been locked in a trade dispute since 2018, when the Trump administration imposed tariffs on more than $360 billion of Chinese goods, and China retaliated with tariffs on more than $110 billion of US products. US meddling in the South China Sea and provocative speeches by US officials have also angered China, with Beijing accusing Washington of being the direct driver of tensions in the region.
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanahu.
Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to The Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this special episode, we select a short part of Imam Khomeini's will. We take pride that the fifth Imam, Baghir al-Ulum, peace be upon him, is the greatest personality of history, and no one but the Almighty Allah, his messenger, and the infallible Imams has appreciated his status. We take pride that we belong to Jafar's school of jurisprudence and fiqh, and ours, a vast and endless ocean, has been developed by him. We are proud of infallible Imams, and we pray our allegiance to them. We take pride that the infallible Imams were imprisoned, lived in exile, and finally became martyrs while enhancing Islam, implanting the Holy Quran, the establishment of just and righteous rule being one of its dimensions, and while toppling the tyrannical governments and the oppressors of their time.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al-Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Al-Khomeini was quoted saying, "Don't think that we weep and arrange these mourning meetings to please the master of martyrs. No, he has no need for our tears, and our tears per se cannot do anything. But these lamentations and gatherings and meetings unite the people and give them direction." Throughout history, the Ahlul Bayt, the Imams, the holy infallible Imams, they emphasized and instructed their followers to hold morning gatherings for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, for many reasons, of course, and reasons maybe we will never know.
When your horse returns to our camp riderless, and your son and I emerge out sorrowful, why did you leave us to fend for ourselves? Hussein, Hussein, the slain martyr.
What's apparent is that throughout these gatherings, we are united. So the Imam Khomeini says, united, and he used the word direction. That when you see masses throughout Ashura, the days of Ashura, the first 10 days of Muharram, or through the 40th of Imam al-Hussein, Arba'een, when you see millions of people getting together, rallying for one purpose, going for one direction, which is Imam al-Hussein, salamullah alayhi, then that is a message to every tyrant. That's a message to every oppressor. That's a message to show that we have an aim, that we have a goal, that we have a mission. And that scared the tyrants from the times of the Imam until our modern day. And Imam al-Khomeini, he emphasized on the fact that we need to come and weep for the Imam. Because it's not a matter of weeping. We are gathering.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. And as usual, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at how the collapse of the US-backed government in Kabul and the return of Taliban is likely to affect two key regional players, India and Pakistan. And we shall discuss the never-ending tussle between New Delhi and Islamabad over influence in Afghanistan and the changing regional dynamics.
In the wake of dramatic turn of events in Afghanistan and Taliban's stunning comeback after 20 years, regional powers are jostling to protect their interests in the strategically important country. Recalibrating strategies in line with the new reality seems to be the way forward. For the past 20 years, the two South Asian strange neighbors, India and Pakistan, vied for influence in Afghanistan. While India invested heavily in infrastructure projects using its soft power, Pakistan was accused of harnessing the Taliban as its proxy.
The strategic location of Afghanistan, lying at the crossroads of Central Asia and South Asia, has enticed many powerful empires over the centuries. It has also drawn many regional powers towards it. India and Pakistan, the arch rivals who have fought three wars, being the two leading protagonists. These two countries have always had presence in the landlocked country. But since the US invasion in 2001, their footprints increased considerably, albeit in remarkably different ways, to the point that many regional observers accused them of engaging in a proxy war. While keeping its military out of the war-ravaged country, India invested in key infrastructure projects since 2001, to the tune of $3 billion. From the strategic Zaranj-Dilaram Highway in Nimruz, Salmo Dam in Herat, new parliament building in Kabul, and a cricket stadium in Kandahar, the use of soft power significantly bolstered ties between New Delhi and the US-backed governments in Kabul. On the other hand, Pakistan remained at loggerheads with the successive governments in Kabul, who accused Islamabad of providing sanctuary to Taliban leaders and using the group as its proxy. Pakistan, nevertheless, remained a key player in Afghanistan and played an instrumental role in facilitating Afghan-led talks in Doha due to its leverage over the Taliban.
when Taliban took over Afghanistan in 90s, there were three countries which accepted a Taliban government: Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and UAE. None of other countries accepted it. So Taliban became a very isolated and a poor country, and the difference of opinion continued. And all the people who are opposed to Taliban from Afghanistan took refuge in India. Abdullah Abdullah, Hamid Karzai, and all of them. When 9/11 happened, these people were put in the power after throwing out Taliban. So Pakistan is in a very positive and important strategical ally of Taliban from the first day. They trained them, they harbored them, they even financed them. So I think it is very important to understand this historic background, and now Pakistan is quite happy with Taliban taking over again.
With the US installed government in Kabul out of the picture, and the ragtag group of fighters announcing their return with a proverbial bang, many believe the emerging situation favors Pakistan and represents a setback to India, which made massive investments over the last 20 years. While Pakistan has already started engagements with Taliban's interim government, India is also beginning to soften its stand towards the group it never recognized. New Delhi has come to realize that cold shouldering it this time would only boost Islamabad's leverage over the group.
Barely hours after the Taliban laid siege to Kabul on August 15th, completing their astonishingly rapid advance across the country, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan was among the first to endorse it. He termed Taliban takeover as breaking the chains of slavery.
جب آپ ذہنی غلام بنتے ہیں تو یہ یاد رکھیں اصل غلامی سے زیادہ بری ذہنی غلامی کی زنجیریں توڑنا زیادہ مشکل ہوتا ہے جو ابھی افغانستان میں غلامی کی زنجیریں توڑ دی انہوں نے.
The statement not only illustrated Islamabad's intimately complex relationship with the Taliban, but also revealed its pent-up frustration at the successive governments in Kabul and their Western patrons. The last 20 years since the American invasion in 2001, relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan were marked by deep acrimony, but that might as well change now with a friendlier government in Kabul. Pakistan was one of the few countries to recognize the Taliban rule in late 1990s, and it played host to Taliban's top leadership since 2001. The goal primarily was to contain Pashtun nationalism at home and counter India's growing influence in its neighborhood.
Since occupation of Afghanistan by the Western forces led by NATO and USA, they relied much more on India, because all the president and leaders who were put in power in Afghanistan were either supporter of India or have lived during the last struggle in India, Abdullah Abdullah, Hamid Karzai, and everybody. Now, Western world were not relying on Pakistan because they thought, the Western world, that Pakistan is playing double game. While he's supporting the Western countries in after 9/11 to destroy the Taliban, at the same time, they are supporting Taliban because all the Taliban leadership was still either in Pakistan or was living in the areas where Pakistan has influence.
India, which always considered Taliban a terrorist group, has lately been holding talks with the senior Taliban leadership, which points to growing realization in New Delhi that engaging with the group is critical to protecting its strategic interests in Afghanistan and countering Pakistan's influence and leverage over Taliban. While Islamabad clearly seems to have an upper hand at the moment, recent statements from Taliban officials suggest the window is not entirely closed for New Delhi.
The shadow of India-Pakistan proxy war, driven by competing interests, has always hung like a sword of Damocles over Afghanistan. From the Soviet invasion in the 1980s to Taliban's rule in the 1990s, when the two countries found themselves at the opposite sides of the spectrum. The proxy war was again on display recently, when Pakistan was seen backing the Taliban in the fight for Panjshir Valley, and India went out of its way to support anti-Taliban forces.
Panjshir, the picturesque Hindu Kush Valley in northern Afghanistan, had always been the bastion of anti-Taliban resistance. But earlier this month, Taliban managed to breach the valley's steep, rugged terrain. Ahmed Massoud, the son of legendary anti-Taliban commander Ahmed Shah Massoud, blamed it on foreign mercenaries. The salvo obviously was aimed at Pakistan. Some reports quoted officials in Panjshir saying that Pakistani military had bombed the valley with drones in support of the Taliban. What set tongues wagging was the whirlwind visit of Pakistan spy chief Faiz Hamid to Kabul to meet senior Taliban leaders like Mullah Baradar. The astonishing claims, which could not be substantiated with irrefutable evidence, were amplified by the Indian media. Barbar Iftikhar, a spokesman for Pakistani army, termed it a malicious propaganda by India, while Pakistan's National Security Advisor Moeed Yusuf linked the accusations to a fake news network created by India. The din of claims and counterclaims only brought to light the long and murky proxy war between the two arch rivals, which has manifested itself in Afghanistan in recent years. The former Pakistani military ruler Parvez Musharraf warned about it back in 2014, when he admitted that the danger for Pakistan is the Indian influence in Afghanistan.
While it's true that the new political dispensation in Kabul presents advantages to Islamabad in terms of regional power play and the ability to influence political developments in the country, there are some legitimate concerns as well, which have accentuated in recent days. It's the same case with India as well, despite New Delhi's recent overtures to Taliban and the group's assurance that there would be no anti-India activity in Afghanistan. There is growing fear that Taliban's resurgence could pave the way for the growth of anti-India militant outfits.
Despite Pakistan sharing a unique relationship with Taliban, the Imran Khan government is not entirely relaxed about the group's takeover in Afghanistan. The issue of Durand Line, a de facto fence between the two countries, remains a bone of contention. Taliban spokesperson Zabiullah Mujahid's recent comments on the issue have caused jitters in Pakistan. Another issue is about Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. Pakistani governments have for long claimed that top commanders of the militant group operate from the Afghan soil, while Pakistan expects Taliban to act against them. The group believes the issue needs to be dealt with by Pakistan. Pertinently, in the chaos that followed Taliban takeover recently, hundreds of TTP fighters were released from Afghan jails. Afghan refugee crisis is also likely to determine the course of Taliban-Pakistan relations. The country, which already hosts around 3 million Afghan refugees, has refused to register newcomers. India has its own concerns about Taliban's triumphant return. The group had traditionally close ties with anti-India militant outfits like Lashkar-e-Toiba and Jaish-e-Mohammed that operate from Pakistan. Haqqani Network, which is the part of Taliban, was allegedly behind the bombing of Indian embassy in Kabul. And New Delhi fears Taliban's comeback might affect security situation in Indian-controlled Kashmir. India's concerns also stem from Taliban's close ties with Pakistan and China, two formidable regional rivals of India. With American exit, China's involvement in the country is likely to increase, which will further undercut India's interest and influence in the country.
We've spent so long, 20 years, for, you know, and we haven't